We're having an argument already, and Pat comes in early to join in on this. That's not what the 00 status means. They didn't make this black woman a James Bond. They gave her James Bond's 00 moniker because he left. So it doesn't make her James Bond.
Right. But James Bond is gone. It's a James Bond movie.
No, James Bond comes back and he wants to come back in, but she's got his 00 status because he lost it.
Oh, so how do we replace you with a transgendered Asian? How does that happen? Can we get that into effect?
I would love that, but let me use that as an example. They wouldn't become Glenn Beck. Would just be the host.
Are you working for the film company here?
Oh, my God.
This is agonizing.
This is the Glenn Beck program.
We can only hope that I have another vocal cord experience this summer. Oh, that would be great.
We could bring in a black woman to replace you.
We could. We could. Mm-hmm. We could. And I wouldn't have a problem with that.
No, it's time. I think it's time, right? For a little diversity.
You know, if there was a black woman that had, you know, my traits, having her on, giving her opinions on this show would be fine.
Well, of course it would.
Right.
Yes.
Your problem is you think James Bond is being replaced by a black woman and James Bond is a guy.
That's
true.
So you're the problem.
I'm the problem here. Yeah.
Jesus, love of feet.
I'm just
tired. No, you want to have it. Wait.
Of the diversity.
Right. If you want to have a
mandate.
Problem. I know. If you want to have a problem. Have a problem with the guy who is replacing James Bond as James Bond. He's always been a white guy. Mm-hmm. He's not a black man. He's always been a white guy. If you want to have that conversation, okay.
What is he now?
He's white.
He's still white.
James Bond, yes.
Who's replacing Daniel Craig?
The guy who, he's great actor. Don't remember his name. He's a black guy, but not in this Bond movie.
but not in this one. Is becoming Bond.
What?
Right. A black guy is becoming
Bond.
Yeah,
is becoming Bond. And so, you know, if you want to just, you know, flush all of the history of this guy with it was like what's his name did one Bond movie and he was like sensitive and I'm not going to be bad with
Timothy
women.
Dalton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's not James Bond.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We know who James Bond is. He's a white guy from Scotland.
Right.
We got it. Yeah. Okay? He's not a black guy. Right. Now, that one you could have an intellectual argument over on. Let's stop changing the stories. Can we please stop changing the stories? Mm-hmm. Just for political correctness. Mm-hmm. But, can we move on with our lives? Because it's freaking James Bond. The 007 status in this particular movie, James Bond is still Daniel Craig. And James Bond is pissed because his 00 status is gone and he wants it back from the new person that has that 00 status.
And
so he's still
person,
James Bond.
Right. So and then they're just so basically what they've come up with a way to justify the diversity move here in the story and you're accepting it. That's essentially what we're learning.
I'm trying not to hate everybody and everything.
I'm trying not to be, guys,
I was just in New York for the last week.
Well, I know, and speaking
it is
of that,
the worst.
Like Hamilton was interesting because I don't know if you know this. Alexander Hamilton wasn't black.
What? Shut up.
What are you talking about?
No, he wasn't. He was
Shut
a white
up.
Guy. He was a white guy. Now if we What if you'd made Martin Luther King
a white guy?
Can you imagine the
hang on just a second. Wait. So would you have a problem? Because I wouldn't. Would you have a problem with a great actor who happened to be black playing one of our founders if it wasn't all about this stupid diversity thing? So in other words, a great actor could play Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, it would be hard. You have to go farther away.
Let's go the other way. Is it okay for, you know, a white person to play black people? We look back at that in history and we say that's negative, right? We look back at blackface and say that's a bad idea unless you happen to be governor of Virginia. It's a really bad idea.
Right, because it was demeaning. If you played the role right, it still would not be acceptable in our society because of political correctness.
But it's just also dumb. Right? Like there's you know what? There's mm-hmm. black people and black founders, by the way. Yeah. They can have black people play the black founders. It would be great to see some freaking movies about that.
Yeah,
I'd
love
to see
that. It would.
Tell the real story.
It would.
Which we've done.
It would.
I just don't. I mean, like, and then you see Scarlett Johansson getting in trouble because she said she should be able to play anyone she wants. Right. She should be able to play any tree
or
bee or whatever it was that she wants. And that's being seen as this, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe.
How dare she? Well, because she got a role taken from her because she's not trans. So I guess now only trans people can play a trans role.
And that's so stupid.
It's stupid.
And like, it's stupid. But wait a minute. Hang on just a second. What's the difference between white and black?
Right, exactly. I think it's just the real visibility, right? I think Daniel Craig took some heat at the beginning when he was named Bond because he was too short. Like, this guy's too short to be Bond. People noticed that.
Well, no, yeah, but that's ridiculous.
Well, but it's not.
Tom Cruise is 5'1".
Right, but Tom Cruise is playing like
Tom Cruise is standing on a box. Like 5'7". You just can't see him standing on
the
box.
And because it's hidden. You can't do that with skin color. It's just a really obvious trait.
Right.
You can't do it like if you had, even if it's like long hair, right? Like there's things that you can alter to make the person appear like the person they're playing. And so you do those things. You can't do it with skin color. That's why it's the most obvious
one. I have to tell
you. Or gender.
The hate here. We need Marianne Williamson here. because the hate that is happening on this show right now.
Overwhelming.
Overwhelming.
That's true.
Now, I don't know. Yeah. Did you guys hear the Marianne Williamson prayer?
I have not yet.
Now, this is not cult-like at all. This does not feel like some sort of... Mm-hmm. spooky, you know, what's that name of that movie, Somar, or something? That movie that's out right now? Yeah. It's nothing like this.
Definitely doesn't sound like Get Out Part 2. There's definitely
no.
You're not going to feel that here.
Here it is.
Marianne As Williams. I speak, I'm going to ask the white Americans in the room to please repeat after me.
Okay.
On behalf of myself and on behalf of my country, to you and all African Americans, from the beginning of our nation's history, in honor of your ancestors and on behalf of your children, please hear this from my heart.
Can't be from your
heart. I apologize. Please forgive us. With this prayer, I acknowledge the depth of the evils that have been perpetrated against black people in America.
It's too long.
About in America.
From slavery to lynchings. To white supremacist laws, to the denial of voting rights, to all the ways, both large and small, all of them evil, all of them wrong, for all the oppression and all of the injustices. I apologize.
Is this a never-ending prayer?
Stop. Yes. Yeah, I know. The Lord is like, okay, all right.
I got it,
for the love of Pete. Okay, so does she then say, now, turn around and reverse this?
Oh, surely they just left that out of the video.
So she doesn't do that.
Are you saying that black people have to apologize for something, Glenn?
I think all Americans need to apologize for a lot of stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. We've done that on this show where I've come out and said, hey, I made some mistakes and I apologize. It's always good to apologize. It's always good to recognize someone else's pain. But it can't be a one-way street unless it's God on the other end. When you're apologizing to God, you don't go, well, it's your turn now. Okay? He has nothing to apologize for. But everybody else has something to apologize for. There's nothing wrong with this recognition if it would just stop there. But this isn't going to stop there.
Well, except these aren't the people that are responsible for slavery and discrimination laws.
Yeah, that's where the real issue is. There,
yeah,
right?
No, like, I know.
It's not them.
And
they didn't do it.
What a creepy moment if you happen to be one of the African Americans there.
Like, there's and just they're being touched during that time?
Touched like, the entire time throughout the 12-minute prayer. And they've got their hands on the guys. There's like apologizing. Wouldn't you? I mean, every African American I think I've ever met would be like, dude, first of all, hands off.
Yeah.
Second of all, you don't need to apologize to me for something that you weren't even alive for.
Agree with you. And I think many African Americans agree with that as well. The ones who are
going to Marianne Williamson prayers.
pull themselves up by the bootstraps, they are not there. However, we do know that it is important through AA and through all religious organizations, it is important to recognize the pain of others and just to say, it's good and I apologize, I am with you, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But the problem with it is it doesn't stop there. Now I have to pay you reparations. No, wait a minute, what? I'm recognizing your pain. I had nothing to do with you causing your pain, but I am recognizing your pain because you are a human being just like I am. And when I have pain, it feels good for somebody to come up to me and say, I'm sorry for the loss of your mother. Okay, you didn't kill my mom, dude. Why are you sorry? Because I'm recognizing your pain. And so when it stops at that, I'm sorry for your loss. When it stops there... Okay, but it doesn't stop there. What happens is, I'm sorry for the loss of your mother. I know. Thank you for that. Now, pay me money.
Right. I mean, I know Williamson in particular is advocating for about $500 billion in reparations.
Well, we have it.
Oh, yeah, we've got plenty of extra money.
Yeah.
We're the richest nation on earth.
Yeah.
That's the least we can do.
Amen.
The least we can do.
I think she said. I think she's the one that said it was anything under $100 billion is an insult. Like, it would be
she's right.
If we gave
that.
Her them, if we gave African Americans, and again, how you'd figure out who gets the money and who doesn't, whatever, that's impossibly complicated. But if we gave them only $99 billion, that would be an insult. Just the $99 billion.
What about the African Americans that would find it insulting to take reparations? And what about the African Americans who didn't have that weren't here?
Well, here's the thing: we don't need any more black faces that aren't black voices.
Wait, what?
Oh, yeah, no. You can't do that right before I go into a commercial. You cannot do that. Stand by. Forget you heard that, because that is another can of worms we're about to open up. All right. So, you know, it's not called the gang. It's the squad.
The squad,
the squad.
Yes.
The squad.
Named after, I think, Taylor Swift.
Her people were the squad. They're not a posse anymore. They're a squad.
Right.
Well, it's the mod squad.
Yeah, yeah.
They're a modern squad. It's the mod squad.
And there's nothing more diverse, I think, than Taylor Swift.
I like to call them the four horsewomen of the apocalypse.
You may be right.
Uh-huh.
You may be right.
I think they might be.
Okay, so there's a couple of things. First of all, at the Netroots over the weekend, I think we have this, Stu. I just saw it a few minutes ago at the Netflix conference. Somebody took the stage and said, not Netflix, Netroots, and said, you know, we don't need any more black faces that don't want to be black voices.
Yeah, it was, I believe it was Brown, to be clear. We don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice, from Presley. I think we do have the clip here. Do we have that?
For whatever lived experience and identity that you represent, if you are not prepared to come to that table and to represent that voice, don't come. Because we don't need any more brown faces that don't want to be a brown voice. We don't need black faces that don't want to be a black voice. We don't need Muslims that don't want to be a Muslim voice. We don't need queers that don't want to be a queer voice.
Queer is made. What a wonderful recovery the word queer is made.
Yeah, okay.
What an incredible achievement.
And stereotypes, please don't even show up. Because we need you to represent that voice.
No, what we need you to do is represent your district and all of the voices in your district. You are a representative for your district. See, this is the problem. This is what our real problem is in America. We have decided somehow or another that anybody who goes to Washington is supposed to represent their voice, their people. No, you're supposed to represent the people in your district. White, black, yellow, brown, doesn't matter. All of those people and only those people. You're not there to speak for America. You're there to speak for the people who put you into office. This is the problem that our founders saw with national government.
And of course, putting yourself, always defining yourself by some characteristic, the color of your skin, your sexual preference, whatever it is. It's always this sort of group identity. But I mean, again, and you may have noticed that at times it's not a great idea to call public officials racist, Glenn. I don't know if you've discovered that yet in your life. But it's,
yeah, I've seen that lesson taught once.
But apparently you're the only one who's heard it. Because one of the easiest ways to figure out if something is racist, if you're just not sure, is to reverse the colors. So if a representative were to come out today in the news and say, we don't need any more white faces that don't want to be a white voice, do you think the media would notice that comment? How they're dealing with Donald Trump tweets right now.
Try this. We don't want any Christian that doesn't want to be a Christian voice. She just said, we don't want any Muslims that don't want to be a Muslim voice. Well, wait a minute. That's kind of scary, isn't it?
Hey, I mean, like, at least, at the very least, at least Muslim Christian is an ideology, right? It's at least a collection of beliefs.
Yeah,
black
but
is not a collection of beliefs. White is not a collection of beliefs. It's just a color.
So what does
it
that
should be
mean?
Completely meaningless.
Does
right.
that mean that we only want to hear from black people who are progressive? Is that
100%,
right? What she's saying?
She's saying I don't want Tim Scott.
Right.
Right. Like I don't want.
If you're a conservative black, you're not really a black voice.
Right.
And we don't want to hear from you.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Exactly. I mean,
if you're Hispanic and you're conservative, you don't have a Hispanic voice. You don't have a brown voice.
Right. I mean, like with all of these things are coming out. Well, these racist tweets by Donald Trump against people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, he must hate all people with any Hispanic descent. Well, I don't know. Did he hate the guy that you guys got fired this week, Acosta, who he had as labor secretary? Yeah. Did he hate him? Because, I mean, you guys all pressured him. He had one of the most powerful jobs in the world. Now he doesn't. You're actually taking jobs away from Hispanics. But no, we have to completely ignore these things. The idea that you can say that you want someone who's going to speak for a race is so fundamentally at odds with what we were supposed to do.
And I have to tell you, though, I think it's all coming undone. I really do. Look at their polling numbers, which surprisingly was an internal DNC poll leaked by someone in the DNC. They're taking out their own now. The other side is starting to fight back. Mm-hmm. They're at 9% approval rating.
Alon Omar 9%.
That's not a big posse or troop
squad.
Welcome to the program. We wanted to have Tim Alberta on with us. His new book just came out today, American Carnage. And I would imagine it's going to get a lot of coverage in the media because people will say this is an anti-Trump book. However, I just got this copy today, so I don't know. But there are a lot of interesting things in this book, and everybody is on the record in this. This is not a hatchet job, at least that I can see at this point. Tim Alberta is with us, author of American Carnage. Is this a bash Trump book?
Good morning, Glenn. Well, no, I don't think it's a bash Trump book. In fact, I sat with the president in the Oval Office for a pretty lengthy interview for the book, and I think that I was awfully fair to him, and I actually just got off the phone with somebody at the White House about 20 minutes ago and had a nice conversation about the book.
Okay.
I think the book examines the president and his administration for what it is, nothing more, nothing less.
So it was interesting to me because there's a lot of things in here that I have never heard before. For instance, the way Pence went and was kind of pursuing Donald Trump, which I didn't know, and the things that he had done, trying to say, well, if this doesn't happen, you know, then this vice presidency is not supposed to happen. And he actually spent the weekend with Donald Trump. And what he said about Trump afterwards was pretty remarkable, I thought.
Yeah, you know, their relationship is, I think, pretty poorly understood. And it's obviously an incredibly important relationship because most people in the president's orbit, and I think the president himself, believe that he would not have won the election in 2016 without Mike Pence on the ticket.
Right.
And obviously, they're two very different individuals. I've covered Mike Pence for a number of years. I know him and know the people around him pretty well. And Pence went from being the pursued to being the pursuer very, very quickly, and it was very surprising to many of his friends. And essentially, the backstory in a nutshell, Glenn, is that once Pence actually met Trump and spent the weekend with him and got to know his family and they played golf together a couple of times, he sort of became convinced that the caricature of Donald Trump was very different from the person, Donald Trump. And that began this very sort of odd couple relationship. And I don't need to go chapter and verse on all the differences between the two men. But Pence came away from all of it thinking, you know what, not only do I like this guy, but I would love to get on a ticket with this guy.
Yeah, he said that he is really inquisitive. And you don't get that from the president at a distance. That he is, that he was constantly asking Pence questions about everything. And he said he was extremely sharp. Again, another thing that you don't really get from the mainstream media and Donald Trump's appearances.
Yeah, Trump's executive style here is pretty interesting. He has never been, you talk to people who work with him in the business world, he's never been somebody who wants long meetings, very structured day, conference calls, things like that. Trump essentially gets information by quizzing people, almost interrogating people, like rapid fire style, and he kind of takes what he needs and he discards the rest. And that has been sort of his reputation in business and now in politics. And it's funny, Glenn, if you talk with, you know, Republican lawmakers who will go over to the White House, they'll sort of walk out of there in a daze, and they're not quite sure what just happened, and they think that he absorbed some of the things they were trying to tell him. And in reality, to Trump's mind, you know, 90% of what they're telling him, he doesn't care about. He feels like it's ephemeral and or that it's peripheral to the matter at hand. And he is sort of trying to filter out some of the political BS and just sort of focus on, you know, the crux of what it is they're trying to get him to do or not do, you know, depending on the day.
I was interested in the part of the book where you're talking about AOC, that Trump admires her. And this is really you have to really understand the context here. But he admires her and says she's Evita.
Ava Perón, Evita. Yeah, it was probably the most surprising moment in our interview. And as a quick way of background, we were talking about populism, and I was trying to understand from the president, you know, philosophically, what does it mean to be a populist? And so I was asking him, for instance, about, you know, AOC had proposed this tax on the ultra wealthy. And I was asking him, you know, because there was polling showing at the time, you know, a whole body of polling showing that this wasn't popular just among liberals, but actually there are a lot of blue collar conservatives who don't mind at all this idea of a tax on the very, very wealthiest members of society. So I was trying to get at that with the president, and he was pretty evasive on that question. But then unsolicited, he basically started writing a love letter to AOC and telling me how, you know, on the one hand, he doesn't think she knows anything and that, you know, she's got a lot of learning to do and that she's over her skis, but he was enamored of her. And he, you know, I just reading between the lines, he did not say this verbatim, Glenn, but I could sort of tell that Donald Trump, I think, sees in AOC a little bit of himself, which is to say that he sort of exposed the old Republican establishment as kind of feeble and slow and incompetent and a little bit complacent. And AOC has really begun to do the same thing to the Democratic establishment. And I think he sort of tips his cap to her and recognizes the talent that she has in kind of overturning the old order.
Right. And so it's not a love affair with her policies or anything else. He just...
No, no.
Because I think the same thing. She's effective until I saw the DNC polling numbers that they leaked out about her, where, you know, they have around 9% popularity in the country, which is pretty astounding. Can we go to the TikTok, if you will, of the Access Hollywood crisis?
Sure.
Tell the story of what happened that day.
Well, you know, the short version is that this is Friday morning in October, and on that Sunday night, Trump was preparing to debate Hillary Clinton in St. Louis. It was their second presidential debate. So they were holed up in the 25th floor in a conference room at Trump Tower, and it's Donald Trump and Chris Christie at a table. Chris Christie is portraying Hillary Clinton in this debate prep session, and Reince Priebus, the chairman of the party, he's acting as the moderator. And the president's advisors and some of his family members are in the room, and they're all kind of offering some feedback. And one by one, everyone in the room starts to leave, which is pretty unusual. And at one point, Reince Priebus looks up, and he kind of scans the room, and it's just the three of them, he and Trump and Christie. And Priebus says to Trump, you know, when everybody leaves the room at the same time, something's going on. And at that moment, Trump, who hadn't really realized it either, he looks outside of the room and he can see through the plate glass doors that all of his high command of the campaign is gathered, sort of whispering in hushed tones just outside of the conference room. And Trump yells at them. He says, yeah, what the hell is going on out there? And there's this long passing moment where nobody quite knows what's happening. And finally, the door swings open, and Hope Hicks, the communications director for the campaign, she comes in, hands a stack of papers to Donald Trump. We know now that that stack of papers was a printed out email exchange with a Washington Post reporter who had obtained that Access Hollywood tape. And Trump is reading through the remarks, and he suddenly stops very abruptly when he sees some of the vulgar remarks. And he says, this doesn't sound like me. I don't think this is me. And Reince Priebus is losing his mind at this point because he's saying, what the hell is going on? Somebody please tell me something. So Trump gives the papers to Reince Priebus. Priebus sees the same comments, and he basically immediately says, this is fatal. I mean, we're done. This is it. This is as bad as it gets. Really, the only person in the room at that point who thought that it wasn't lethal to the campaign was Jared Kushner. And he pipes up and says, you know, I don't think it's all that bad. And everyone sort of rolled their eyes. But basically, everyone else in the room that day, from Steve Bannon to Dave Bossie, Kellyanne Conway, the president's children, they all thought that this was it, that he was toast. And, you know, explain how he survived the weekend, essentially.
Did the president feel that he was toast, or did he know, I can get past this?
You know, from everything my reporting has told me, Glenn, that was the one moment in the campaign where he felt like that things were probably cooked, that he was already fighting a little bit of an uphill battle, that, you know, he had professionalized the campaign a little bit and surrounded himself with some really good people who are veterans and who had a lot of polling and you know, data analytics to show him that this was going to be really tough, that he'd really have to pull off an inside straight. But they weren't pessimistic up until that point. I think that weekend did hit Trump that, you know, I probably am going to lose. But that made him all the more defiant, frankly. He was going to lose on his terms. He wasn't going to be pushed out of the race.
So there's another piece here from the RNC colluding with Rubio's campaign and the South Carolina GOP to stack the debate hall against Trump heading into that primary. And I remember that it was quite a lively debate in South Carolina. But this is the same thing that the DNC was doing to Bernie Sanders in favor of Hillary Clinton, is it not?
Yeah, well, it's similar. I think the difference is that, you know, Hillary Clinton was always looking at a coronation as the Democratic Party's nominee. And obviously there were some folks in the party establishment on that side who were just sort of annoyed with Bernie Sanders and kind mm-hmm. of viewed him as a pest and wanted to get him out of the way. Whereas on the Republican side, Donald Trump was becoming a runaway train. After winning the New Hampshire primary by nearly 20 points, everyone in the party apparatus who had sort of scoffed at Trump for the better part of the past year was suddenly coming to terms with the fact that this guy was not only the front runner, but probably the prohibitive front runner, because he had placed second in Iowa and then he had, you know, cleaned everyone's clock in New Hampshire. So there was this reckoning, Glenn, after the New Hampshire primary. They had 10 days until South Carolina. And during that period of time, I document it in the book, you had, you know, senior party officials reaching out to top party consultants talking about trying to orchestrate some sort of 11th hour kind of pirate operation to take down Trump. You had all kinds of talk about Oppo leaks. You had Mark Short, who of course now works in the White House, a very prominent White House official, but Mark Short at the time was running the Koch brothers political network, and he went to Wichita and asked them for $10 million to take down Trump on Super Tuesday. Essentially, the fear among all of these folks was that if he won South Carolina, he would then have such a head of steam heading into Super Tuesday that this thing was going to be a runaway. And so what the RNC actually did, and that's Sean Spicer, who of course became press secretary, Sean Spicer and Katie Walsh and some others inside the RNC, they got together with the South Carolina Republican Party, the chairman of which is a guy named Matt Moore. He did not like Trump. And they got together with the Rubio campaign, and essentially they stacked the debate hall with Rubio supporters who drowned out Trump in booze, basically everything he said that night.
Wow. How did Spicer end up on Trump's team?
Well, how did any of these people wind up on Trump?
He was working for the he was working against the president. Well, I guess they all kind of were. Priebus was as well. That's a stupid question. I retract that.
It's true, though. Throughout the book, that's a recurring thing where these people who were very anti-Trump during the campaign wind up with roles in the including Pompeo, right, which is something I had never heard before from the book. Tim, can you go through Pompeo and
can I take a break and have you come back?
Oh, okay.
Just take a break and then we'll come back in just a second. More. The name of the book is American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. We have Tim Alberta on. He is the author of American Carnage. It's a book that is out today and really fascinating. We only have about 2.5 minutes, so this is really unfair to ask you. But I'm fascinated by the stories of Pompeo and Haley in the book. But perhaps in this time, you only have time to answer this question. Is there a possibility that Trump would ever replace Pence with Haley for political reasons?
No, not from my reporting, Glenn, and I can tell you why. It's first and foremost, the president does really prize loyalty, and no one has been more loyal to Trump than Mike Pence.
Right.
Through thick and thin,
yep,
we have seen that time and again. I just can never see Trump doing that. And I think, secondly, Haley would have zero interest in it. Nikki Haley is very clearly positioning herself to run for president in 2024,
right,
whether that's after a second Trump term or if Trump loses in 2020. Nikki Haley is... it's the worst kept secret in politics. She is very clearly positioning herself, readying her team to get her own presidential campaign off the ground in about 2022. So she would have no interest in joining Trump's ticket.
How is Trump feeling about this coming election? Is he feeling pretty confident? Do you get a sense of anything real?
I think he's confident in watching the Democratic Party right now, that this very large primary field and, frankly, just the sort of cultural and political forces that drove the Republican Party farther to the right over the past decade, that they are now doing the same thing to the Democratic Party, pulling it farther to the left, and that they may ultimately nominate someone who simply does not have the appeal to white working class voters who are going to wind up probably tipping the scales in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And I think that is probably the president's best hope for re-election, because if he can win those three states, then he probably can win re-election. And Democrats have to be very careful not to nominate someone who is outside of the mainstream, somebody who does not have the ability to connect with a lot of those Obama-Trump voters. I think that is what keeps the president optimistic at this point.
Shh. Keep that to yourself, Tim. Keep that to yourself. All right. Tim Alberta from Politico. The name of the book is American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Thank you so much for joining us, Tim. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks.
God bless.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
That's fascinating stuff, because, I mean, we all went through that together, and it's like a history book about what was going on behind the scenes, you know. In a story that we're all involved
in this book
at some level. Yeah.
Yeah. The president set for this book, and mm-hmm. all of the sources are on record, you know, and he talked to each of the sources one on one. He talked to Pence and everything else. And so it does seem more like a capturing of history at that time, not a gotcha smear book. Although there are things in there that I'm sure the president isn't going to like. It's interesting that he was on the phone with the White House this morning as this book comes out.
Yeah.
And they were talking, you know, this morning. Fascinating book. It's American Carnage.
You're listening to Glenn Beck.